Hey guys, welcome to MAU Talk, a new podcast from MAU Vegas, the premier mobile acquisition and retention summit. On today's episode, we have Adam Hattie, VP of Marketing at Current. He's going to be talking to us about mobile influencer campaigns
from a marketing perspective.
Take it away, Adam.
All right, welcome to MAU Talk. I am very, very pleased to have a fellow Adam here joining me. Adam is a longtime industry friend. We definitely met through MAU, although I don't, perhaps you could recall where you were career-wise at the time. Currently, somewhat pun intended, he's the VP of growth, or perhaps just marketing. I don't know, growth, yeah?
Marketing.
At Current, it was just kind of a challenger bank. You can definitely tell us more about it. So Adam, super appreciate you doing this in lieu of your MAU stage time for 2020. And welcome to our podcast.
Thank you so much, Adam. You know, I don't even think of you as another Adam anymore. You're just his own person. Most other Adams, I think of them as a subset of me, right? They're like, they're, you know, but no, you've moved beyond that.
It's an honor. I've transcended the name.
And I think we met at, it was the second MAU. I'm not sure how you did the first without me, but great job.
Where were you at the time, career-wise? I mean, obviously you were in the mobile place, but what was it?
I was working at Topps. Topps, the baseball card company. This was back in kind of the heyday of where I would talk about us as like digital collecting and digital goods. And people would think I was crazy because who would pay any money for a digital good? And, you know, lo and behold, Pokemon Go, just all of, you know, gaming right now in general, yep. League of Legends, you know, that Fortnite, right? All these skins. That's where I was.
And tell us, for those who are not users, what is Current? What is this thing?
So Current is a mobile bank. We're a bank for those overlooked by traditional banks. Most people listening to this podcast, right? Most people within our space, we're likely professionals earning a professional annual salary. And with that annual salary, you can kind of go into any bank and be like, hey, I want to check an account. And they'll be like, great, we're Bank of America and you'll be a great customer for us. For about half the country, that's not the case, right? If you're an hourly worker, service industry worker, a gig economy worker, perhaps a creative who doesn't have like a steady direct deposit, you walk into Chase or Citibank or whoever, and you're getting charged monthly maintenance fees for not having enough money in your account. You're likely paycheck to paycheck, right? Meaning you're near a zero balance. You're probably getting hit with overdraft fees and you're paying hundreds of dollars just to maintain a checking account. So it's a very different experience depending on how much money you have, right? And so we're a bank for the latter, right? And we can be that because we have far fewer costs than a traditional bank. It's actually pretty crazy when you think about banking today, right? Because if you were to start a bank today, there's no way you would be like, oh, you know what we need to do? Open up thousands upon thousands of brick and mortar locations and employ, 100,000 people around the country to manage this, right? You would never do that. But yet, like, the old traditional banks have chosen, yeah, let's keep this. This makes sense. And to be honest, it kind of does for their business model, which is basically to sell what is effectively an expensive product to a wealthy audience, right? And so that's why, and essentially the way that they get by with that is that they subsidize these checking accounts in hopes that you'll make money with them by, number one, depositing a bunch of money there that they can then lend out. Number two, by upselling you into like a credit card or even better, a mortgage, right? And so this entire expensive lead gen essentially makes sense on the back of that. But again, that only makes sense for the half of the country that's going to do that. For the other half of the country, the 25-year-old who's working at Amazon or working at Best Buy or working at Walmart or driving Uber, they're not going to do any of those things, right? And so the banks purposely make their experience terrible so that they can focus in on the wealthier customers. And so
Okay, excellent. So you have a true growth marketing background at Tops and in subsequent companies. I know you've done a ton of consulting over the years. So I'd love to hear how those sort of tactics, we'll call them traditional mobile growth tactics, how they apply in fintech. Like, I mean, a lot of people listening will understand what it looks like in e-com, will understand what it looks like certainly in gaming, but like, what are some of the learnings that you've had of things that do and don't fit for the category that you're in now?
Yeah, certainly. Well, I mean, on a technical basis, right, we're a mobile app and the actions in which we're driving people to do and ways in which they engage with us is measured mostly through a mobile app, although obviously you have a debit card as well, and there's offline things that happen there. So from a technical perspective, there's a lot of similarities. I would say on a less technical perspective, dealing with people's money is a lot broader than anything I've ever personally worked on in the past. You know, we talked about Tops, but, you know, I've also worked on daily fantasy sports. Right. What did I need to know about you to acquire you as a daily fantasy sports customer? Basically, like, do you like sports? Which sport do you like? And are you over 18 and in a qualifying state? That's all I didn't need to know anything else about your life besides that to know that you were a qualified user and could be a good user. Right. The same kind of applies towards like e-commerce. Right. Oh, you like these boots? Great. That's, you know, I didn't need to know anything beyond your life to acquire you. In our world, it's much more complex, right? I need to like your entire context and how I speak to you is really, really important. Where you work, what your priorities are, what your pain points are in life, because money is so critical to life and how you live it. And so I'd say I've taken a lot of like, you know, the performance stuff from my past and had to incorporate a lot of broader marketing and broader understandings of people's lifestyles. And I think that goes for, you know, not just, you know, fintech, but a lot of non-gaming. And even the category of non-gaming, that's like a hilarious way to describe an industry. And only the mobile world does this, but kind of speaks to how ingrained we are and how, you know, I mean, gaming has been so much of a part of, you know, the early days of performance marketing. And, you know, I've learned a lot from my days working in gaming.
All right. And so there are a lot of challenger banks that have different bits of functionality. Have you seen anything tactically from an acquisition standpoint that you've observed amongst competitors that you were either super surprised at, like seeing something that only fits in the category that you're in, or things that you think probably were not, like were obviously not very effective that you were happy to have avoided? Can you think of anything that comes to mind?
You know, I'm going to do my best not to throw too much shade here at the competition. You know, I've seen some interesting things for sure. You know, millions upon millions of dollars spent on, let's say, like an outdoor campaign for maybe a business that had not yet even been established, kind of speaks to like a fundamental misunderstanding of how, you know, real people respond to advertisements in the real world. It's not to say that, hey, outdoor advertising is some stupid channel. No, I don't think that's the case at all. But maybe not the direct response channel to introduce a brand into somebody's life. You know, you look at something like I'll mention SoFi. SoFi, very bold move. They have bought the naming rights to SoFi Stadium in LA. That's crazy. I think it's like $20 million a year or something for a startup that's like pretty. I mean, you know, Barclays. Which is Barclays, which is this, you know, insanely old financial brand doing the same in Brooklyn. You know, very different valuations there to both be spending about $20 million to name a stadium. I'm not saying that was a great decision or a bad decision, but if it was a great decision, the logic behind it would work for a company in fintech that maybe not for a company that's more strictly direct response, right? Like SoFi Stadium, that instantly solidifies SoFi as like a legitimate player, right? Because now, like, you know, they're right there with Chase Arena. Or again, we mentioned every bank has a stadium somewhere, right? And when dealing with people's money, that level of trust is incredibly important. And for the most part, when I speak to other people who I work with in fintech, our focus really is on conversion and down funnel metrics much more than it is top of funnel.
Sure.
You know, every company says this, but in banking, it's really, really, really true, right? You know, we ask, you know, our core metric that we're driving towards is direct depositors. That's who we truly consider a customer. Once you've switched your direct deposit to an institution, that's really who your bank is, if I ask you who your bank is. And for us, you know, when we're talking about a customer who's paycheck to paycheck, I'm literally asking them for all their money, right? Like, and that's it's a crazy ask because, hey, what happens if that doesn't work? You know, it's so you really, that level of trust is super important. So when I look at a company like that, you know, hey, we're not buying stadium naming rights anytime soon, but at a certain scale, I can see how that can make sense, right?
Yep.
But how would you feel if you refinance with SoFi? And like, I don't know, like there's a lot of risk there. It's a very risky proposition. And there's actually a lot of nuance and there's regulation. And, you know, hey, how do you qualify for certain federal programs? And it goes on and on and on. But point is that that may seem crazy and would probably be crazy if, let's say, the equivalent in, you know, the mobile world of like, you know, we had a Clash of Clans.
Machine Zone.
That might be a little bit more absurd, but I don't think it is in the case of finance.
Right. And in looking at the category, not even banking, but all fintech, I imagine a challenge is that your optimization events are pretty deep into the experience and pretty delayed. Like, sure. In gaming, you know, can you get somebody to complete the first level? In e-commerce, can you get them to take the first purchase? Those are sort of different depths of engagement. Imagine signing up for a bank and switching direct deposit. I mean, I assume that takes time and there's a relatively low conversion rate. How do you deal with that on platforms where you're optimizing for events? Like, do you still, you know, tell Facebook, tell Google UACs, yeah, I want people who, you know, do this direct deposit thing, or do you have to go upper funnel to like make those systems play nicely?
The straight up answer is you definitely have to go upper funnel, right?
Yeah.
But you know, you can't, I mean, hey, if you know, you want to try to optimize for an event that happens once, most likely offline, you know, 4 weeks from now, like you're going to have a very tough time running effective campaigns. I mean, that's just not actually feasible. Or even close to feasible, even if under better circumstances, not even close to feasible in the world of like modern performance marketing, right? Certainly on the mobile side. So yeah, as you can imagine, we have events way further up the funnel that act as a best predictor of this. And without giving away too much of the secret sauce, these are mostly synthetic events, right? They're not explicit user events. And I think a lot of companies have moved in this direction where it's not, you know, it used to be, oh, pleading like level 7, let's say, or whatever the equivalent of like this explicit event might be, or you know, an add to cart, this explicit event.
Right, but some sort of score or index value or something, right?
So obviously being able to predict that and model that out is hugely a big part of what we do here.
Okay. Awesome. Now I'm gonna switch gears a little bit. So I know that you have had a lot of experience personally and in prior companies with influencer stuff writ large. First of all, you've told me some crazy stories over the years. So I don't know what you can share, but like, could you talk a little bit about what sort of influencer campaigns, paid or organic, that you have been involved in, or what the sort of shape looked like? I mean, are we has it been YouTube stuff or, you know, stuff on Instagram or elsewhere? Like what has your mobile influencer experience been over the last couple of years?
Yeah, certainly. I'm glad you were paying attention at my MAU talks, Adam.
Oh, very closely, always.
No, it's evolved over time. So I've influencer marketing, even as a term, it's like, what does that mean? It can mean a lot of different things, right? It can mean, you know, in my world, it mostly means performance, right? Yeah. It's a performance channel, just like Facebook is, just like Google is. It's a channel that has its own distribution, its own metrics, and ultimately have a CAC that it drives towards. But it can mean, you know, content. It can mean basically affiliate. It's been used for all these different terms, right? It could be like a brand ambassadorship. You know, whenever influencer marketing became a hot term, probably like 5 years ago or something. Yeah. It kind of got adopted by all these different territories. And so, yeah, I mean, I've treated it primarily as a performance channel, although it's very useful for all those other things I just mentioned as well. And so, you know, we certainly build a lot of content using influencers here, and that's a big part of our story, our brand. In terms of funny stories, I'll skip that.
I was hoping that was me. I was reaching. What about if you're comfortable sharing? You know, put current aside for the stuff that you've done. Have you done more on YouTube versus Instagram versus Twitter versus whatever, or has it been everything?
It's been a little bit of everything. It really depends on your product, or, you know, and again, I consulted on this for years. And, you know, I had a lot of people who would come to me and be like, hey, you know, like, I don't know, I am working on like a, you know, let's say like home improvement, which, you know, hey, home improvement is clearly has an older audience, but could be found on YouTube. That's actually a decent category of like do-it-yourself home improvement types.
Sure.
That exists on YouTube. Even though demographically YouTube itself is a really small channel. So if you were to, you know, separately come at me and say, oh, like our average audience is, you know, 45-year-old men who really care about sports, you're not really finding that user on YouTube, right? Like that's like, you know, maybe on like some highlight reels and things like that. But generally speaking, there's not a huge audience for that. And so YouTube is a really young platform. Instagram is certainly older. You know, TikTok started off, well, back in the Musical.ly days, certainly very, very young, has consistently been skewing older, especially this year. But, you know, sits maybe somewhere between YouTube and Instagram. Snapchat has kind of grown older as it's matured as an audience. It used to be this young platform. Now all of a sudden those, you know, 17-year-olds are 22. And so it really depends on where your audience is. But for me, YouTube's certainly been a bread and butter channel for me. I think the influencers on YouTube really carry the most influence. And that's a really important like concept in all of this that often gets lost beyond just the metrics. You know, like you can get plenty of views and let's say comparing it to like a meme account on Instagram, which, hey, I'm not trying to diss meme accounts. They have a lot of value within themselves. But a meme account telling you to download an app, it's like how much does that really carry?
Yeah.
Think about the commitment we make when we watch a YouTube video. It's like the biggest commitment we make on the internet. Like, wow, I'm going to click into this thing, load this up, and like sit back and watch. That's crazy. We don't do that with anything else. Yeah. We do. It's like this really big commitment, and these influencers themselves, it's such a personal connection, much more so than you would get maybe just scrolling through a feed.
Yeah.
So that's why YouTube's been a channel that I've liked. But again, it all depends on where your audience is, and there's plenty that you can do on Instagram. There's plenty you can do on Twitch and live streaming. It all kind of depends on that.
Okay, and I want to pause to say, what was the calendar year when you gave a presentation at MAU and you identified what you thought would be major channels in the future, one of which was, I think, Musical.ly, now TikTok. I got to give you credit for that because you did nail that. What can you remember what year that was?
I think that was 2015.
That was well ahead of the curve, to your credit. Kudos there. To what extent do you think about, so influencer as a paid channel, that's a different perspective than a lot of the quote unquote influencer marketing ecosystem has, for many, yeah. It's a branding channel, but that's okay. One thing that I've at least seen firsthand is that it seems like for performance, like the pricing has kind of gotten out of whack, at least with some individuals. Like there's just enough demand from non-performance advertisers, maybe who are more interested in reach or engagement and so on, that it seems like it's gotten more difficult to find people who are willing to engage on a basis that, could be cost effective on a performance basis. Do you think that, is that take right? Or I mean, is still in 2020, are there plenty of people that you could find out there, depending on the category, where the math could still work?
It's interesting because it's somewhat true. It depends where you are in the market. On like the low level, let's call it like a micro influencer, a nano influencer, or even some lower mid tier ones. That's where you'll often see, a brand or an agency that's not so performance oriented come in and, pay maybe 10x the rate, 5x the rate of more of like a performance rate. Where, it completely blows it out of budget. And I'm like, oh, well, that's great that, Procter & Gamble paid you, $50,000 for this, but I can only pay you $10,000. Right. Something like that. That you'd certainly see. But actually on the top end, when it comes to like the largest influencers, in many ways you see the opposite, which is that, the brands that are not performance oriented don't feel comfortable shelling out, six figures on a campaign that's not performance oriented. But these audiences do indeed warrant that. And so you actually, on the highest tier, it tends to be more performance companies operating there.
Interesting.
So there's kind of this double thing happening in the market. And really, more than anything, this is not like an efficient marketplace with like auction dynamics that you would find, that we're used to on a Facebook or Google, right? It's a lot of this is informal. A lot of this is based on relationships. And that's not like a problem. Often people would think like, oh, well, there'll be a platform that solves for that. That may be the case to a certain extent, but it's actually, the trust that's built, that a lot of what I focus on when I work with creators and that my team focuses on is enabling influencers to, really do what they want to do and create the content that they want to create, incorporate it in a way that's relevant to their audience. This was actually really easy 6-7 years ago. Because that's all they did was create content for their audience. They never worked with brands. And so when I'd approach them, they would come up with all this cool stuff, right? But over the last several years, you've had them essentially be like, what's the term I'm looking for? Basically punished by all these brands who they make something really cool. And then the brand's like, no, this is not correct. This is not to spec. This is a little bit off. And, so they've kind of learned from that to be like, no, I'm just got to stick to the script. And then once I say this, I won't get in trouble and it'll be approved. And it'll be
right at the middle of the video. I cut away. I say the thing. I show the thing for a minute and then I'm back in the actual content. Right?
Yeah. And so a lot of the work that we do is building the trust with the creator that, hey, you can do something cool. You can go outside the box. You can be genuine. And we're going to be okay with that. And so that's a level of trust that, again, you can't communicate that via some automated platform, right? It's just not something that's possible.
Okay, so one more tactical question, and this is less, I think, current specific and more just advice to people. So there's a an ecosystem of influencer agencies and managers, and as you said, at least 20 plus quote unquote marketplaces of influencers that you can either find people or even contract through them. Do you find, or would you recommend going through one of those avenues, like an influencer agency, or have you found it to be more successful to kind of DIY, reach out to people, or maybe a mix of the two?
Yeah, it's, you know, people often, companies often ask me this, and, you know, the answer I am used to giving is like, oh yeah, do it yourself. You definitely got to do it yourself. And it's the most obnoxious answer in the world because, you know, again, this is like, how are we, every company is strapped for resources, and how are you supposed to dedicate resources to a channel that you don't even know will work, especially if you don't even know how it works. So that's not really a fair answer to give. I think more reasonable answer is that early on, it really makes sense to outsource this to somebody who knows what they're doing. Now, how you find who that person is or who that agency is it takes a little bit of more work. But, you know, right out the gate, you're not going to be able to execute an influencer campaign yourself successfully, right? And so I wouldn't try to do that. But ultimately, to build it as a viable channel over time, you do need to do that internally. That's something that's very, very difficult to externalize. A lot of which is for those reasons I just gave you, right? Like you know, me being able to go back and forth with an influencer, or you know, more accurately, somebody on my team. That's like that back and forth and that level of trust. It just creates a much better output. That if you have an intermediary in between who doesn't necessarily have that level of trust, maybe with you, or doesn't have that nuanced understanding of the product, or if you know, you want to create custom stuff for that influencer, you just can't do that through via a third-party agency. I mean, some of, you know, I worked as a VP of marketing at Quid, which is a digital marketplace also for digital goods. Quite the experience in that category. You know, we made custom stickers in our app for the influencers that we worked with, right? So it wasn't an influencer going out saying, hey, you know, go download Quid. It's a great app. It's an influencer saying, hey, go get my stickers on Quid. Again, very hard to do that via a third party. That's something that you ultimately, you know, requires buy-in from a lot of people internally. And, you know, for it to really work at scale, you need that. So that's kind of my advice to companies who are thinking about it as a channel.
Awesome. Okay. And then one more in the influencer realm. If you can answer this, so Twitch and streaming in general, even as a consumer, you know, someone who watches these videos myself, I certainly see lots of cross promotion of stuff pertaining to gaming, other games, you know, energy drinks, keyboards, all kinds of stuff like that. Have you experimented, or either yourself, you know, managing campaigns for your clients or current, or even as a consumer, seen influencer sort of engagements that are probably more of a performance, you know, oriented campaign on streaming platforms from people that are not just pushing games? Or is that a place that makes sense to, you know, people watching games to promote games, do you think?
I've seen both. I think it can totally depend. You know, one of my first clients when I started consulting was SeatGeek, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, we had a lot of success early on with gaming around sports gaming, right? Because obviously, sure. You know, SeatGeek is not a game; it's a ticketing app. But obviously, that's where, you know, an audience exists. A sports fan exists is in a sports game. So that's where I think about it. And that's why you see, you know, the same idea behind like an energy drink, right? And hey, if you're trying to reach a certain consumer, whether, you know, it be, you know, male or female or however old they are, and you can determine a lot by, you know, what game they're watching, right? If I know that you are, you know, streaming Call of Duty or Counter-Strike, that tells me something very different than if you're streaming Minecraft or Fortnite.
Sure.
And so it's, again, we tend to throw all these things in one bucket, but it's the equivalent of like running a TV ad on Comedy Central or on, you know, Oxygen or on,
right.
I don't really know the TV channels as well as I used to.
HGTV. Yeah, no, that's a fair, I think there is a temptation, even myself. Yeah, you think that these influencer platforms as monoliths, right? And, oh, we're going to do Twitch. But like, you know, there's people streaming chess and woodworking and all kinds of stuff at this point. So I think it's kind of an anachronism to think about.
Yeah, I know I can find Adam Lavoe on Twitch, but I get the feeling I can't find you on TikTok.
Exactly right. Exactly right. You might not be finding anybody on TikTok, depending on how the news plays out in the next week or two. We'll see. Okay. And then my last topic, I'm not sure when we're going to release this episode, but this, we're speaking not long after the WWDC IDFA apocalypse business. Without going super into the weeds of the IDFA stuff, just fundamentally, how big of a bearing do you think it has on, you know, what you guys are doing as a team? Like, do you think, oh, this is cataclysmic and we're going to see more concentration on Facebook and Google, or like, you know, things will figure themselves out and it'll be more of the same? Like, how are you guys thinking about it so far? And then it's early still.
It definitely is early. So it's interesting because I think while like a lot of people are marketed as like some huge cataclysmic change and event, iOS 14, really kind of like the second Apple started talking about limit ad tracking, this became a thing, right?
Absolutely.
And in many ways, I think we'll look back, number one, on maybe like, you know, I don't know, 2012 to like 2017 or something as like the golden years of mobile ad tracking. But maybe more importantly, it's now pulling people, you know, it's maybe eliminating a little bit of false confidence that's existed in our existing attribution techniques. And again, this affects way more than just attribution, you know, particularly on the monetization side for ad networks, games, et cetera. But just from the attribution side, like being told, hey, this user came from this ad, even though we know it's imperfect, eventually you kind of get used to this idea that that's some deterministic thing that's infallible. When we all know, like in reality, that's not how the world works,
yeah.
Right? Again, particularly in non-gaming, although even in gaming, you know, where it's susceptible to a bunch of different cases there. But we talk about personally here at Current, you know, we're operating on quite a few different channels, quite a few non-digital channels, where, you know, we need to look at incrementality anyways, right? And that's, I think it's going to force a lot of companies to do that in a way that's ultimately going to be in their best interest. And so I think while this is certainly catastrophic for a lot of companies, a lot of ad tech companies, a lot of, you know, again, depends on what vertical you are, there's going to be a lot of changes that are happening. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, as bad as a lot of companies are looking for it. Because if you're thinking, oh my God, how am I going to do my job without this? As a marketer, you're probably been overly dependent on it anyways. And so this will change that.
It's true that specifically in the mobile app ecosystem, the MMPs largely were effectively last click attribution. Right. I mean, and they had some first click, whatever, but basically they were last click attribution. So you had a whole ecosystem, massive advertising ecosystem, that's basically just been running like hardcore last click. And now maybe has to pick their head up a little bit and be like, you know, maybe an app store, an Apple search ad user isn't really just Apple search source. Like, well, you know, actually maybe they came up on TV camera already or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at like the proliferation, like on how, again, and super sophisticated advertisers haven't been, you know, like spending tons of money on fraud, but you know how I mean, there is, I mean, these fraudulent installs exist for a reason, because like for a certain segment of advertiser, they are susceptible to that. And like the fact that you see, I mean, you know, Uber's a great example of this, right? They spent millions of dollars on were effectively fraudulent installs, and then you know, pulled out and saw, you know, oh, all of a sudden our organics increased. The fact that that could happen at that scale, it's indicative. Like again, in this world in which, you know, IDFAs are effectively dead, you would have never fallen into that fraud hole to begin with. And so it's going to be an interesting world, but you know, there's people who are far better versed in this than I am. So I'm just listening to them like you.
Yeah, and there are a lot of self-interested parties, not in a bad way, but you know, who are building their products and changing their plans, I'm sure, in response to this stuff. So it's I at least personally have found it somewhat difficult to like. It's like, all right, so I read the branch thing. Okay, so now I've got that worldview. Then I just read this Allison thing in AdExchanger. That seemed way worse. Then I read Eric Subert on Mobile Dev Memo. Whoa, like that sounds like a bomb went off. And then I jump over to, you know, the Singular or Adjust guys, and it sounds fine. So it's been, as someone who's not nearly as well versed in it as you know, somebody like an Eric, it's been kind of difficult over the last 2 weeks for me personally to like know what is going on. But I think your point around incrementality, especially, and it's like, you know, media mix now, modeling that, stuff and all that kind of
now
stuff.
Look,
it's fitting.
And I can sit here and not be freaking out because I'm in a somewhat privileged position. But this really, really, really hurts and changes the ecosystem for obviously a lot of ad tech players and things like that. But also on actually the UA and advertiser side. I mean, if you're going to talk about a world in which we're completely dependent on incrementality and media mix modeling, these are things that are really hard to do at medium scale. You know, super tiny scale incrementality is easy because, you know, hey, baseline zero, right? But at like kind of like the small, medium size, it becomes really, really difficult. It really favors big businesses with big budgets. And, you know, so, and certainly, you know, the world of like, okay, well, now I'm just going to stay inside of this walled garden. Although even, you know, it's still unknown that, how, you know, what does Facebook advertising attribution looks like, particularly, you know, optimizing for down funnel events, all the stuff that we just talked about, yep. Where does that go? It's, it forces us to be a little bit more nimble-minded and maybe understand our customers more and behaviors and become, you know, it's funny because we've spent really the last several years giving up lots of control to all these algorithms, right? Where you look at things like UAC and app event optimization, lookalikes, et cetera, that existed for a while. And there's two ways to have gone with that. One is, hey, we give up all this control to algorithms. Now I just become a data scientist and that's where I live. The other approach is actually like, hey, all these algorithms are doing like the heavy lifting on the data side. This allows me to actually just better understand my customer and focus on like the creative and the messaging side. And so I think for maybe the folks who went one route, they might, you know, have a tougher time than people who've kind of looked at both or maybe focused more on, you know, traditional marketing. I put that in quotes.
Yeah. Now, Adam, if people want to find you, because we can put this in the notes. Are you a Twitter person? Could they follow you on LinkedIn? Do you do a newsletter? What do you got anything like that or not really?
Certainly. You know, I'm on Twitter, Adam, it's Adam Hattie on LinkedIn. Most importantly, and my biggest plug is you can find me at current.com/careers. We are hiring here at Current. That's my big plug across the company as a whole. But certainly on the marketing team.
Those are New York based roles, or are you considering remote people?
We are considering New York people because those are the best people.
Okay, fair enough. A little bias there. okay, awesome. Well, I super appreciate you doing this, and it was really great. And until next time, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Adam's information can be found in this episode's description. Be sure to subscribe and visit our website, mauvegas.com, for updates. Catch you on the next episode of MAU Talk.